space exploration has come a long way in the last half century. And yet, when you consider the enormous distances from us to even the nearest star system, it just boggles the comprehension. And none of the technologies that we have at our fingertips are going to be able to get us from here to another star system in a human lifetime. And then 9 years ago, we got this incredible announcement from luminaries in space exploration and a billionaire to fund it, that they were going to create the Breakthrough Starshot Foundation, that this was going to fund what was considered to be the most viable idea for going to another star system. This is where you use a laser to accelerate a lightweight sail with a microchip-sized spacecraft up to relativistic velocity. You could accelerate to 10 to 20% of the speed of light and be able to get to the nearest star system within a human lifetime, and then be able to send pictures home for the first time of planets in another star system. There was great announcements, a lot of famous names associated with this project, and we saw a lot of actual research start to get developed. But then over time, we heard less and less from the Breakthrough Starshot Foundation. We heard less and less of these projects getting funded. And for the last couple of years, there's mostly just been silence. And I have always wondered, whatever happened to Breakthrough Starshot? Well, good news, a journalist, Sarah Scholes, had the same question and actually wrote the story, did the investigation, dug up the answers to what happened to the Breakthrough Starshot Foundation. So here is my interview with Sarah about what she discovered and what happened and what happens next. All right, enjoy this interview with Sarah Scholes. Sarah, it's good to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you too.
So you came to my attention very recently because you wrote just an absolutely fantastic piece of reporting on the state of the Breakthrough Starshot. And my entire audience is absolutely aware of what happened with the Breakthrough Starshot. But I think we all realized that we hadn't heard a lot from it recently, and that you came to the same conclusion and I guess decided you're going to do something about that. So what was your moment where you were like, I wonder what happened to Breakthrough Starshot?
I mean, Breakthrough Starshot, probably like a lot of your listeners, it's just kind of always a little bit in the back of my head, like, what are those guys up to these days? And I think for Scientific American, I was kind of noodling on this story idea of why haven't any interstellar, you know, spaceship projects really gotten very far. Like, you know, a lot of the technology is not totally out of the realm of possibility. And there's this like very excited crowd of scientists, but why did they kind of all fall apart? And then I was talking to my editor about it and she's like, what about, you know, the biggest, flashiest one with the most promise? What if you just focused on this one, Breakthrough Starshot, that maybe stood a better chance than some of the smaller and more academic projects? And also they, like everybody else, were curious, like what did happen? You know, they had this big party, this big press release, all these fancy people, and then just kind of whimpered away. So that began my journey into trying to figure out what it was that had happened.
And I think, you know, from my perspective as a journalist, as a reporter on this, they own the brand for interstellar spacecraft. That, you know, if I'm going to talk about the ideas of sending an interstellar mission, then I'm going to talk about the viable methods, and then I'm going to name drop Breakthrough Starshot as the people who tried to get the furthest along with this idea of sending laser sails, you know, out to other star systems. And yet they had sort of dialed back their involvement years ago. Like a long time ago. So you sort of realize that this is something you want to investigate. So then how do things progress?
Right. So I kind of started just looking over the tiers of scientists who were involved at various levels, you know, whether they were working on the laser propulsion system, the light sail, the spacecraft, the communications, and just kind of trying to get a sampling of people who were maybe not at the top, because I had a suspicion that the top people weren't going to say very much, and just writing like, hey, saw you publish some interesting stuff a little while ago. what's been going on lately with that. And, you know, to varying degrees of success, many more silences and ghostings than actual interviews, but just kind of trying to piece together, like, what scientific progress did they make in these areas in the, I guess, 9 years now since Breakthrough Starshot was announced. And then, kind of going from there a little bit up the chain to see if the brand name, the people, you know, who work for the actual Breakthrough Starshot Breakthrough initiatives would, you know, come forth with what they themselves have been up to.
And so can you give me some examples of some of the projects that you looked into that had been published and then there was either silence or people did get back to you?
There was a lot of interesting work going on at Caltech with a scientist named Harry Atwater and his group were investigating this material to build the light sail. So, I mean, I'm sure your audience is mostly familiar with how Breakthrough Starshot works, but the basics are that we shoot a bunch of lasers from Earth into these very light, very thin sails attached to very small light spacecraft, and that light kind of propels them to a significant fraction of the speed of light, and they go very fast. So this sail, the scientists didn't know what it would be made of because it has to withstand, I think, 40,000 Gs, which is insane, and, you know, 100 gigawatts of a laser and an intense speed in space while also weighing a gram and being, I think, 4 meters wide. So, like, that's a material science problem that people on Earth hadn't solved. And so Harry Atwater's lab was doing a lot of work to try to figure out, can we build something like that? And, they identified a substance called silicon nitride that they could make on a small scale that could potentially work. So they were making progress. You know, they hadn't built a light sail, but they were making progress. And I think that was one of the most concrete things that happened. But they didn't want to talk to me about it, but that's one example.
That's interesting. They didn't want to talk to you about it because, you know, my experience with reaching out to those kinds of labs is generally pretty enthusiastic. You know, I will see a press release or a scientific paper. And so they put their flag down and said, okay, we've done something really cool and interesting. And then I will use that as an opportunity to reach out and do, you know, and interview them and find out sort of, you know, a more public accessible version of what they've done. As it's been a little while since you've heard from them, it does get a lot harder to then get any kind of response. But it is interesting that, you know, the lab is continuing to work on something, but they don't have anything to say. And so was that your experience? Was that sort of more and more you're reaching out to these people who had worked on various aspects of the problem, the lasers, the materials, the chips, and so on, and just silence?
Yeah, I mean, some people were happy to talk about their work. Like, there's a guy named Zach Manchester who works at Carnegie Mellon University who had worked on these very small spacecraft that in his own work he'd called chipsats, in which he did actually launch to Earth orbit, and they were kind of the notional idea for what the spacecraft of Breakthrough Starshot might be like. He was happy to talk. So I think it's kind of like an individual basis. And I think perhaps, you know, some people said to me, I know that, you know, the Breakthrough people, like the people who work for Breakthrough Starshot, are not going to talk to you. And because they're not giving an official institutional response, I'm not going to. So I think my guess is it maybe depends on an individual scientist's tolerance for, you know, coming under scrutiny with Yuri Milner and his foundation. It would be my guess, but I don't know for sure.
Right. Yep. Okay. So then you sort of got this sort of patchwork picture of where things stood across the various kinds of projects that had been funded. And then were you starting to get a sense of, because one of the big discrepancies is, you know, you had calculated how much you figure of that initial announced money had been spent, and it was surprisingly small.
Right. Yeah. We don't have a full public accounting of what they spent, but I do know from a scientist named Philip Lubin at UC Santa Barbara, who has worked on a lot of these technologies for a long time, you know, on the particularly the, you know, the laser propulsion side of things, that he got a couple $100,000 over the course of 8 years to do some of his work, which he noted was actually much less than he'd gotten from NASA to do similar work. It's just there's this brand name recognition for Breakthrough. And he calculated, I think there were around 30 contracts that went out that he estimated added up to about $4.5 million, which is a fair amount of money for me, but much less than $100 million.
And that's what they'd announced. That's what they said, that they were going to be deploying $100 million for this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's funny to me because I think often some of this work requires somebody to say, this is interesting and worth funding. And that's all it takes for then other people to come in and match. And so having, say, Breakthrough Starshot spend a few hundred thousand dollars to validate this, one of these technologies, and then NASA using that as enough validation for them to then pile on and go, yeah, we'll continue funding it because it matches some of our goals as well. That's what you want, I think, is that somebody is finally saying, okay, we're going to clear this logjam, we're going to fund this stuff, and then other people can continue on, and that sort of compounds. But it sort of didn't then continue from the people who were sort of starting this process, which is very strange.
They kickstarted the chain and then didn't continue. But yeah, I mean, that was something I heard from the scientist who did talk to me, who actually felt, you know, pretty positively about the program, despite it not really fulfilling its promises, was that, like, here are, you know, rich and famous people and also, you know, esteemed scientists who are putting their name behind this kind of audacious project to make an interstellar starship in a reasonable amount of time. And that lends legitimacy to this idea that's kind of been fringe for a while. And so they saw that as one of the primary outcomes, like, no matter how much money was spent, the important part is they kind of legitimized this idea. Like, this is not for crazy people. This is something that we could do in a reasonable amount of time, which, yeah, maybe makes people fund it more later. But I mean, I think what my reporting seemed to turn up was the fact that, you know, it might actually not be that feasible right now. It might take a little longer and a little more money than even $100 million was what kind of put Yuri Milner and the Breakthrough Foundation off of the project.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. We'll get to some of that speculation in a second, yeah. But you sort of went then, you know, after talking to these scientists, you, as you said, you sort of started to reach out higher up the chain to talk to people who were actually involved with the foundation. Some of those celebrities who were, I mean, we saw Stephen Hawking, we saw Abby Loeb, we saw Zuckerberg, as well as Miller and others, and then just various, you know, a fairly large organization. What happened as you tried to reach out to various parts of the organization?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, I just didn't hear back at all, like from Yuri Milner himself, did not get a response. Pete Warden and Avi Loeb, who are kind of also at the, you know, the executive lead on this program, did respond, but declined an interview and just kind of said, like, the project is wrapping up its first phase and they're working to find transition partners. So, you know, once I got, a level up the chain, the basic response was, we won't be talking about this right now because things are in flux. So, yeah.
But the way you describe that, reading between the lines, to me, that sounds like the large funding was no longer made available, but the people who had been sort of pulled together to work in this direction, they were going to look for other sources of funding. I've talked to Warden in the past. I've talked to Abby Loeb many times, you know, and they're definitely believers in this kind of a mission. And so, but unfortunately, they didn't tell you, no matter what, we want to still pursue this goal.
Yeah.
And you didn't get that.
No. I mean, I know that there remained a lot of enthusiasm among the scientists on the ground doing the work, who in some cases were, you know, getting other grants or just using their own salaries to continue work because they were so compelled by this problem. Like, how do we make a set of lasers that big? How do we make a spaceship that small? How can it communicate over that many light years of distance? Like, they thought those were compelling enough problems that, like, with or without Breakthrough, they wanted to continue on those. And yeah, I don't know officially how the people higher up think about that continuation, but I know on the ground, the scientists who are compelled by these problems continue to be, and I think on their own are continuing to work on them. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, there is still NASA's NIAC grants. There are other private foundations. There's a bunch of organizations, funding methods, and so on, but it's not $100 million. It's a fraction of that in bits and pieces as people can kind of pull this together. And it's not under this sort of big umbrella. Like, do you have a sense of when this all started to actually go off, not go off the rails, but like, when did this all just sort of get wrapped up quietly and shuffled away off to some other objective?
Yeah, it was hard to pin down an exact timeline, but it seemed like for the first at least, you know, 4, maybe 5 years, there, you know, they were sitting down, they were identifying problems like, okay, here's the amount of, you know, this is the number of gigawatts we need for this laser. What progress do we need to make that happen? What are the problems that stand in the way? And kind of laying those out, then giving people these small grants to work on them. And I think that happened, you know, through at least the beginning of the pandemic, like 2020, 2021 timeframe. And they were meeting as a large group. They were meeting in small groups. And it seemed like the consensus was in the past 2 or 3 years. Like, the money had stopped coming. The large meetings had stopped happening. And in some cases, just it seemed like even people relatively involved were just kind of uncertain about the state of the project and just hadn't heard anything like the communications with the official Breakthrough Starshot initiative had just kind of quietly gone away just in the past couple of years.
And one of the things, you know, in reading your article, and we'll put a link in the show notes, people should absolutely read it, was wonderful, was, you know, you really identified this optimism in the community, and even still now, that this is still a goal worth pursuing, still a mission worth doing, and sort of how well this had sort of pulled together these disparate people into one unified vision. And then, you know, do you get a sense of that enthusiasm is still there for the goal, for the vision?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even among, like, I talked to some scientists who work at the University of Sydney, and they were working on how do we stabilize this light sail. And they, this is just an example of how people are interested in it, but they had used it as a way for some of their students to be investigating like fundamental parts of how relativity works, because the sail would be going so fast, and kind of using this really intriguing question, like, could we build an interstellar starship, to investigate really basic science problems as like a, you know, it's motivating in a way that sometimes, you know, just basic science for its own sake is not necessarily. And so I think, both from like the technology development side, like it's also pretty fascinating. How would you build the world's most powerful set of lasers? Like there's a lot more you can do with that information than just build a starship. And so I think from all of those angles, the enthusiasm continues, and also, you know, people's funding continues from other sources, like Philip Lubin, who I mentioned earlier, was always pointing out that he always got more money from NASA, and that they'd consistently supported him throughout the years, and that just because Breakthrough had stopped responding to emails didn't mean these efforts were over. They were kind of a drop in the bucket to start with, and it was a flashy drop, but like everybody was on this path before, and they will continue into the future.
And you know, my experience is that when you do some reporting like this, you sort of talk to all the people who you think of, but then after you publish your work, then a whole bunch of people pop out of the woodwork and they give you additional information, stuff that would have been very useful if you'd thought to reach out to them. So, you know, after your reporting, have you got any updates on interesting sort of insights that maybe you hadn't known beforehand?
Yeah, I wish there were more, luckily no reach outs. Like you got this story totally wrong, and it's continuing in the background without all these people you mentioned. It was mostly people who had, you know, some people who had been to some early meetings for Breakthrough and then fallen off, or knew some of the scientists involved, just saying like, we also wondered what happened, because I think it's kind of opaque.
Like for me, it would be really frustrating to not hear from Milner and from the people who had sort of initially laid out the vision, because like, why? Do you not still believe that one of the most important things that humanity could do is to be able to cross the gulfs between star systems to actually give us the first ever pictures of another alien world? Is it that it was just going to be too expensive and you didn't want to be the person who planted the tree and didn't get to see the, you know, planted the seed and you get a chance to see the tree grow? Did you ever get an answer to that?
I did not get an answer to that directly from the source. You know, I got speculation from people who were involved, and some of them thought, you know, when the higher ups, and particularly Yuri Milner, discovered that maybe this was 30 to 50 years away instead of 20, like that was too far. He wasn't interested when he discovered that, you know, to make that 30 to 50 years happen, it would, you know, be $10 billion or $100 billion instead of $100 million, that wasn't appealing. But I mean, something interesting that a scientist named Ed Turner said to me was that maybe he came to think that these problems were so, like the technological problems they were trying to solve, the answers were so far in the future that even with us chipping away at them now, it was just kind of futile and we should wait for things to progress and then try to bite off these technological challenges when we were more ready, and that anything we did right now would just be sort of futile. And if we waited 100 years or whatever, you know, it would be better. And I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, I also, and this is, Yuri didn't talk to me, so I don't know, but billionaires do tend to lose interest in projects sometimes, and then they just abandon them. You know, they philanthropically fund things and then decide they want to do something else. And so, you know, that could have happened too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny when you sort of think about it, like that technology stack, super powerful lasers, Gossamer materials, high G-force tolerant electronics. Like there's a lot of things that need to be done. And there's value to kind of chip away and solve these problems for space exploration or in other kinds of material science or whatever. But you can also make the argument, which is that let's just work on other important things, climate change, dealing with computer efficiency, space exploration for the kinds of projects that we have. And then later on, we'll have greater infrastructure and some of that stuff will make more sense. You come back around and you go, oh, okay, now we can approach this in a way that makes more sense. There's a great paper that I really enjoy called The Weight Calculation. I don't know if you've ever read this. I heard about this. Now, so the gist is you can sort of imagine this thought experiment where you send a spacecraft to another star system with a bunch of, say, explorers, and it's going to take them several hundred years and they're on their way. And then technology improves and you send another spacecraft that shows up and goes faster and then shows up and says, hey, do you guys need a lift to the star system? And they're like, why were we even sent if you could have sent us faster spacecraft? And then a few years later, you send another one that picks up everybody. And so it turns out there is an optimal time to wait before you actually spend a spacecraft, because you will always catch up with the previous spacecraft that you have sent, rendering them useless. And that date can be calculated, and people argue about what that is, but it is very far in the future. It is hundreds of years away from now before we can actually truly send spacecraft in the most optimal way. And until then, we maybe have other priorities that we should be focusing on. Mm-hmm. So
that's interesting. Maybe we need to do that same calculation for laser uncrewed spaceships also, and find yes. out the optimal time. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that time spent now is actually just like, yes, you will come up with better materials, but maybe you'll come up with better materials working on some other project that can then be adapted to this purpose.
Sure.
That there's mm-hmm. lots of reasons. So yeah, it's, but did you get a sense that there was any other kind of cohesive leadership who was starting to formulate and pull these people together again?
No, not necessarily, because I think, you know, the leadership that was in place, in particular on the science side, you know, Avi Loeb and Pete Warden, it seemed like, you know, they were perhaps the people who were not communicating with the different research groups working on these particular problems. My sense is that the people who had been collaborating on, say, you know, the communication system, how do we get information back from the Alpha Centauri system, that they had been working together for these numbers of years, and they were just continuing on their own, just, you know, the emergent property of the system of they just kind of keep on in their own little problem sets and all the research groups they've sort of formed.
Yeah, I mean, that specifically is the group I know the best, mm-hmm. And have interviewed several members of those teams who are, as you say, and recently Marshall Eubanks and his group had gotten funding from NASA NIAC for this, you know, using a huge fleet of these small spacecraft as a way of being able to send messages back home together, like a big antenna. Like, there's a lot of these ideas that are continuing on, and I guess it's like the most viable ones are finding some funding and continuing on, but nobody is saying, hey, everybody, let's keep in touch. Let's try and align on what we're doing. It's sort of broken back up into the individual people working on what they consider to be scientifically interesting problems and no unifying brand anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're waiting for their next billionaire to bring them all back together again.
Yeah.
I don't know who that is, but.
Well, I mean, I think the answer is that we can't wait for the billionaires to decide how we should do it. Like, it feels more like it needs to be a bottom up thing.
Yeah.
But,
maybe they'll listen to this and decide that's
exactly
what they need to do.
Perfect. Everybody will come together. They'll build this new, collaboration and proceed. Sir, I'd like to change gears now and get an update on a book that I interviewed you about a couple of years ago. You were sort of looking into the UFO, UAP enthusiasm and sort of trying to understand sociologically what was going on. But we talked before sort of this recent UFO craze that's gone on, you know, the military, the Air Force is giving testimony, NASA pulled together a panel to work on this, the government, there's been a lot going on. Have you been sort of keeping track and sort of thinking about this since your book?
Yeah, I have. I mean, not necessarily quite as closely as when I was writing the book, but it does seem like the fundamental shift that's happened since the book came out was like, I was tracking the enthusiasm largely among, you know, the us types, just like the people on the ground.
Yep.
Like, why is the average person kind of obsessed with UFOs? And, you know, some, what does that have to do with government investigations of them and things like that? But since it came out, the government investigations have become the thing. Like, there are these congressional hearings, there are official investigatory bodies within the Department of Defense, you know, doing statistics, taking reports, investigating those reports. Like you said, NASA trying to go through and see, like, what data do we have that might be useful? And then also some private companies trying to take, you know, we're going to use AI to take what we see in the sky and classify it and see what's truly anomalous. So it seems like less of a just like hype and emotional enthusiasm time for UFOs and more of a data-driven one, which is interesting. And I think, you know, brings its own complications, but I think maybe provides a way for us to find, you know, I'm not like a UFO alien on Earth believer or anything like that, despite my interest in all of it. But I am interested in like how many things up in the sky are truly anomalous or seem truly anomalous versus what is just something that looks weird and we could kind of figure it out. And I think, you know, the Air Force or the Navy or NASA trying to investigate those things is the way we find that out and, you know, home in on whether there actually is something, whether there's a there or not. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I personally feel like the question of whether or not we're alone in the universe is almost the most profound question that humanity has ever asked. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, maybe like, why is there something and not nothing might be even more profound. But then you ask, like, are we alone? Are we the only, are we the only intelligent species in the observable universe? And then people will, and the gut answer is, of course, we're not, right? Like, that's ridiculous. How could, and then you say, well, where is everybody? And you lead into the Fermi paradox. Mm-hmm. And yet for a lot of people who are seeing these things in the sky, they've got their answer.
Right.
Which is that we're not alone. We're being visited. They're right here, right now, all around us. And yet people just refuse to believe what they're saying. And And I wonder, you know, why is this now? I mean, like from almost like the sociological side of this, why is it reaching a higher crescendo now than it has been in the past? Is it new technology? Is it new outreach from the military? Why?
Yeah, I mean, historically, you know, both people on the ground and militaries have been more interested in UFOs in the strict sense of just like there's something unidentified in the sky in times of high tension. You know, like the beginning of the UFO era was like World War II going into the Cold War. And, you know, there were new missiles, there were new planes dropping bombs, like paying attention to what was in the sky and also just like being on high alert for, you know, invasions or unwanted sky things of any kind was just like part of people's consciousness. And I sort of think the same is true now from like a very official national security standpoint of like, we don't want those drones flying over things that we don't want them flying over. And for us, like, you know, it's a heightened time in the world. And I think just like being on edge and then also seeing, oh, hey, you know, what are those things flying over those Navy ships? Should I be worried about that? And it's just like, and yeah. And I think, you know, some sociologists have said like, it's a way to displace fears about, you know, very earthly things. Like in times of high conflict in the world, if you could take all that stress you feel about that and put it on like, well, maybe I should be worried about an alien invasion instead. Like that's psychologically comforting. So I think there's a lot of stuff at play.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. Like, there's no question that there are balloons in the sky. You know, people have caught the Chinese sending balloons into U.S. airspace. I've heard like 70% of the casualties in the Ukraine-Russia war are due to drones. Like, these are threatening things. Right. That there is this, you know, there's an advancement of new technologies, hypersonic missiles. The Chinese are developing their technologies. Like, this stuff, like, just perfectly explainable technology is a little unnerving.
Right.
And then if something has, you know, incomplete information, then you can sort of let your imagination fly on what it is that you're looking at, mm-hmm. which compounds it. But there's like a set amount of resources available. And as we saw, you know, less and less every day sometimes, to analyze things that we see in the sky. And then you have to decide, is it a better use to deploy this giant artificial intelligence network that's going to be scanning the sky and looking for weird things? Or does it make more sense to send a spacecraft to 3i Atlas?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Priorities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And can't do everything. Yeah.
No.
And I mean, I think honestly, a lot of the UFO lobbying and things like, you know, congressional hearings and things like that are partly an attempt to capitalize on like the public interest in UFOs to get very real funding for like, what is that drone and is it going to attack me? Like to take that public interest and kind of parlay it into to like a real national security problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting that the system designed for finding UFOs or like aliens would also be very handy for finding actual legitimate balloons and drones and stuff that are being deployed, yeah, that we know of. That's interesting. Yeah. And I always, like, whenever there's this big thing going on, there was, you know, I don't know if you remember 2012, and everyone's like, okay, this is it. The world's going to end in 2012. Oh, yeah. We just went through rapture September, I think. Mm-hmm. And you always think that, okay, this is it. This is your moment to help people approach these kinds of topics more scientifically minded, more skeptically, more, okay, let's wait for evidence. And I've been sort of thinking, okay, well, like there's this big kerfuffle about the UFOs and yet no disclosure has happened. No information has been released. Nothing, even though the, like, literally now there are laws that are like, you're not allowed to hide UFO information. Nothing is coming out. No evidence that scientists can actually study. Is this going to decrease people's interest in this topic now? Or is it just never going to go away?
I think it's never going to go away. I think all of this happens in cycles, as they say on Battlestar Galactica. All of this has happened before. All of this will happen again. And yes, it's we will never be rid of them, I think.
But, yeah. So we have to be prepared for the next Mayan calendar to end.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm ready. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I was on a cruise at the Mayan, at the center of the Mayan Empire to watch the world end last time. So
that's exciting. Tempting fate for sure.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I was right there ready for it. So what are you obsessed with right now?
I think I'm obsessed with something that's a bit of a departure from all of this, but I'm kind of obsessed with what's going on with various militaries in the Arctic right now. Just been following lots of military exercises and trainings and things like that up far north, and just I'm an outdoors person. I live in the mountains. So like from that perspective, I'm interested in it. And I'm also just like, what are they up to up there? Yep. So working on figuring that out.
It's interesting. You know, here in Canada, this is a big topic. Mm-hmm. Partly because of the sort of degrading relationship between our country and the United States, as well as the ever opening Arctic because of climate change, the loss of sea ice, and that, you know, there's a lot of projects that are collaborations between the US and Canada in sort of this whole, the dew line, all this sort of early warning stuff. And there's a lot of operations, joint operations that happen in the Arctic, in Alaska, and so on. So, it's funny, you know, as Canadians, we actually think a lot about the Arctic.
Yeah, I bet.
and the country that's on the other side of the Arctic Ocean from us, and right, what they're up to, mm-hmm, in Europe and so on. And it's interesting. Well, I can't wait to find out. Or maybe I don't want to know what you find out.
Well, it sounds like I have some stuff story to find out from you. So,
all right. Well, we'll share some information. Okay. Sarah, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Again, congratulations on a real tour de force of journalism. I'm jealous that Scientific American was able to publish that article, but you did a great job, and I look forward to your work.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Sarah Scholes about Breakthrough Starshot. Now, I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nielsen, Dave DeVeribaff, David Giltenet, David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smith, Michael Purcell, Monzo, OneStepForAnimals.org, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Cheplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I'm going to give you some final thoughts. One thing that I need to bring up, and Sarah and I were talking about this after we did the interview, and I completely gapped on this, and I just want to talk about this, which is that another project very similar is Breakthrough Listen, and this is funding telescope time on radio telescopes, searching for signals from alien civilizations. And that work is ongoing, and that funding is ongoing. And so, you know, while Breakthrough Starshot has dialed back, Breakthrough Listen is still going. And so there's still this enthusiasm for trying to find evidence of aliens out there, and while not necessarily to send spacecraft. And I think it's the technical challenge. One is relatively doable with the technology that we have on hand. The other could take centuries to accomplish. And so we just don't know what's going to happen. You know, how do I feel about this? To be honest, I was quite enthusiastic and excited about Breakthrough Starshot when it first came out. And, you know, we reported a ton on that. And I've said those words many times in the various videos that I've done. And I need to now dial back on me promoting, essentially, an organization that no longer exists. But that enthusiasm for space exploration, for us being able to send a spacecraft to another star system, is still there. It was pent up. Breakthrough Starshot helped sort of direct it into one angle, and yet a lot of people are independently still working on these various projects. And I think that anyone, you know, the next billionaire maybe, who wants to create a legacy, can help to fund these projects and bring people back together and help fund it. Or not a billionaire, maybe it's a grassroots, grown from the ground up, series of people who want to be able to make this thing happen, and understand that it is an enormous technical challenge that might not be seen in our lifetimes. And yet the answers it could give us, the pictures we could get, the new knowledge that we could gain would change everything. And so it is something that is worth doing to bring out the best in us and to take on the challenges, not because they're easy, but because they're hard. All right. I hope you enjoyed this interview. We'll see you next time.